how can you encourage the accumulation of wealth that we know is tied to environmental amenities in cities? How do we get that to flow to these communities?
This is Civios, your source for public affairs research. A podcast from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota.
My name is Melanie Summer here at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, and I'm pleased to be joined today by one of our assistant professors, Bonnie Keeler, who is in the Center for Science, Technology, and Environmental Policy area. She's an assistant professor who is also the co-director of the CREATE initiative here at the Humphrey School. Professor Keeler, welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, we're very curious about the CREATE initiative and hoping that you could explain a little bit about where it came from and what exactly it is.
Sure. So the CREATE initiative is a program based at the Humphrey School, and it is funded by the Grand Challenges Initiative, which is an initiative through the Provost's Office at the University of Minnesota, which was an attempt to address grand challenges. And the grand challenges that CREATE focuses on are issues at the intersection of water and equity. The origin story of the project is, I think, pretty non-traditional with respect to research projects. So we really wrote the grant that funded the initiative with two objectives. The first was to integrate some of my work on environmental policy, specifically water management, with my colleague Kate Derrickson's research. She's a faculty member in geography here at the University of Minnesota, who's worked with on social justice issues for her entire career. Kate and I recognize the intersection between the work on environment and social justice, and both of us had been working on issues that touched on that intersection, but not in a way that was fully integrated, that leveraged both of our expertise. So we saw a research opportunity to do work that was interdisciplinary, that looked at the real root causes and the interactions between how we manage the environment and how those decisions affect people, especially historically marginalized communities in urban areas. And then the second objective was that Kate and I were both looking for a project that represented a different way of doing research at the university. I think we were both frustrated by a model of research where you come up with a research question within your discipline, and then you go out in the world trying to find an appropriate place to test that question. And recognizing that the kinds of challenges that we face are really difficult for academics to articulate and fully understand before doing the research. So we wanted to envision a project that passed the reins of project and question articulation over to community members who are really the ones who are living the intersection of these issues, and to have them explain to us how what the environmental future was that they saw for their communities and the issues that they were facing, and then to envision a project that realigned the resources of a major research university in service of those objectives. And we thought that hadn't really been done in a way that met the kind of expectations I think that we had for real community-engaged, mission-driven scholarship that was both rigorous from a disciplinary perspective, integrated across different disciplines, and was responsive to community concerns.
Let's back up a minute and talk a little bit more about the water and equity issue that you raised. Explain what that means.
Yeah, great question. So water affects people's lives through many different ways. Of course, it's a public health concern. We all need water, sufficient water for household consumption. And then communities have problems both when there's too much water and you have flooding, but also when there's not enough water. And Kate Derrickson had been working with communities in West Atlanta where they had a whole suite of water-related problems. So there's because of decades of disinvestment in stormwater infrastructure, communities in West Atlanta would flood anytime there was a major storm event. And the flooding also brought raw sewage into people's homes and created the perfect conditions for West Nile virus and caused mold accumulation in households and a real cycle of disinvestment where you'd have higher rates of vacancy and then property values would go down. So there was this real explicit connection between the quality of water and how it was managed in a community and the way those decisions impacted communities of color. And then the solution to that water problem in Atlanta was proposed to be investments in green infrastructure, which is something that I've worked a lot on, which is basically the concept of using nature to protect, to provide environmental benefits in cities, such as stormwater retention. But in order to do that, you have to have space, and that space often was taken from these very same communities. So taking a neighborhood and displacing them in order to build a stormwater retention pond or a park or a green space may solve that water retention problem, but of course creates all kinds of other consequences that are of concern to communities. So both displacement and then the process of gentrification, which is rising property rents and a feeling, a loss of a feeling of belonging with those communities. So we had known about these issues in Atlanta. This is based on Kate's work for decades with those communities and knew the intersection between environment and social justice was very prominent in that area, and also knew that those issues were playing out in Minneapolis. And so the project was to really have a curiosity about how those issues were playing out in the Twin Cities, what's specific about an Atlanta context, what's specific about a Minneapolis context, what's generalizable about these patterns that link how we manage the environment with how that affects communities in urban areas. And I think it's a really timely question because we see cities in the U.S. and all around the world investing in climate mitigation strategies, this idea of greening cities, putting in million tree campaigns, investing in green infrastructure and stormwater solutions. And those campaigns are good and necessary and important interventions to address climate change and improve urban sustainability, but they're often not considered in the context of inequality in cities and the historical patterns and policies that have led to really segregated and unequal cities, especially with respect to the urban environment. So we are really trying to understand the connections between those issues so that as we're making those policies around greening and creating sustainable cities and adapting for climate change, that we're doing it in a way that's embedded in the historical context of those neighborhoods and also is really responsive to the concerns of the communities that both stand to benefit from those policies but also potentially have a lot to lose. So really understanding that nexus was the gap that we were trying to fill through CREATE.
And I know you had a team of researchers over the summer working in those cities, and let's talk about Minneapolis for a moment. What did those researchers find or work on during the summer in Minneapolis?
The work in Minneapolis, so I should say that all of our work has been informed by a group we call the Policy Think Tank, which is a group of community leaders from Minneapolis and Atlanta and from other places that help guide our work. They're sort of the board for the project, and they help us shape the research agenda and decide on the research projects that this group of students worked on, which is called the CREATE Scholars Program. It's a graduate program for students across the university to get experience doing community-engaged scholarship and thinking about how to be an environmental leader that's sensitive to issues of social equity. So the students were brought together in teams of three or four students, and they were assigned to one member of the policy think tank that both served as a mentor and also a project advisor. The group in Minneapolis really focused on this issue of green gentrification. So Minneapolis is considering a proposal to redevelop 50 acres of publicly owned land along the banks of the Mississippi River, which is called the Upper Harbor Terminal Project. And that's adjacent to North Minneapolis, which is one of the largest, one of the lower income neighborhoods and also one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the Twin Cities. And then community members adjacent to that big redevelopment project had a lot of very mixed feelings about what that project might mean to them. Was it going to actually deliver benefits to the community? Was it going to establish public spaces that they would feel were for them? Would it allow them connection to the Mississippi River, which they have been excluded from in part because of highway construction in that area? Or was it just going to lead to rising property values and rising rents that would mean that community was no longer able to stay there? So that's that sort of in a nutshell is this concept of green gentrification, which hasn't received the same amount of research as gentrification that results from things like highway or transit investments, for example. So there was a gap there in our ability to really help these communities anticipate what changes this redevelopment project might have for them. So the students were responding to that inquiry from our community partners. And they did a combination of things, a lot of mapping. So they looked at property values adjacent to both that redevelopment site as well as other parks around the Twin Cities area that had received investments to try and understand if park investments were correlated with rising rents and property values. So we started to collect the data to analyze that question. We also provided some maps that showed the context of why the city is segregated and how it's segregated, how certain communities, especially white communities, have received better park infrastructure and are located in proximity to some of the highest quality, most visited parks in the Twin Cities. And then there was another student who did a narrative focus of the project where she went out with a videographer to communities and allowed them to tell their personal stories about their hopes and dreams for that site. So it was a combination of both quantitative data and some statistical analysis, some modeling, some GIS and mapping work, as well as a really lovely video that demonstrates how community members perceive the potential of that redevelopment area.
So how is the work that was done that you just described, as well as your ongoing work through the CREATE initiative, how is that going to be relevant to public policy and to people who are making the decisions?
As we started to scope CREATE, in addition to involving the community partners through our policy think tank, Kate Derrickson and I and our staff spent a lot of time doing outreach with policy communities. So a couple of targets include groups like the Met Council, the Minneapolis Parks and Recreation Board, the City of Minneapolis. And what we found was a real hunger from those organizations, actually, to understand these dynamics. And so I think there is a real willingness and a eagerness among those agencies and organizations that have control over everything from zoning to park expenditures to long-term planning in Minneapolis to do that in a way that's addressing issues of equity as they make those kinds of investments. But what we also realized in conversation with those groups is that there was still a lot of misunderstanding about those concepts and a need for clear, policy-relevant, actionable items, right? People didn't need to know more about that issue. They wanted to know how to solve it. So in addition to some of the other research that we're doing with CREATE, we spent a lot of time trying to develop a very action-oriented policy toolkit that accompanied the research initiative.
So tell us more about the toolkit. What does that mean?
The toolkit is called Sharing in the Benefits of a Greening City, and it's focused on anti-green gentrification initiatives. So this concept of green gentrification that I mentioned would be the unintended consequences of investments in parks or green infrastructure in cities that can have negative impacts on communities, especially communities of color. There are couple of different ways to try and mitigate that impact. And so our project looked across a broad suite of those different policy tools to try and understand which are the intervention points or methods that can be best used to transition some of the power back over to community members, to help them advocate for what they want, even help them understand what they could ask for. So a couple of examples include things like community benefits agreements, which are agreements made between community members that might be affected and a developer or a city who owns the land or is overseeing a development process, where they can ask for certain things like certain units of affordable housing, or they can put in inclusionary zoning policies. They can ask for a certain number of jobs to be based in community or to use community contractors. They can have some say over the kinds of development that happens and the site layout, how it's managed, over what time scale it's managed, shared revenue models. So there's many of these different kinds of community benefits agreements or zoning policies that are ways that community members can advocate for the sort of development and the flow of benefits to reach their communities and not just end up in the pockets of the developers.
And so obviously what you're saying is that because of green gentrification, these issues occur, but the alternative is not to forget about those investments in communities that have been underrepresented.
Yeah, and this was really beautifully articulated by one of our policy think tank members who talked about this as an idea of a rut. These communities are going from historic policies, discriminatory housing policies like racially restrictive housing covenants and redlining that have excluded them from these environmental benefits directly into a future where trying to ameliorate that injustice is going to displace them again. And so how do we change that story? How do we help communities break out of that rut? And that means that we have to try some pretty innovative tools. And that was really what this policy toolkit aimed to do, to understand how can you encourage the accumulation of wealth that we know is tied to environmental amenities in cities. How do we get that to flow to these communities in a way that keeps them in place, keeps them connected, provides those benefits, but does it in a way that doesn't displace people?
How successful do you think that will be, the community organizations using these toolkits? Is that something that you think will be accepted and become more common practice?
It is becoming more common practice. So there are now many communities of which we reviewed a bunch of case studies as part of developing the toolkit to really understand how these methods are being used in different places. So the toolkit includes a description of the instrument, whether it's a community benefit agreement or rent control, and then who's supposed to use it. Is it something that communities advocate for? Is it something that the municipality would enact? Is it on the developer's shoulders to do this? And then where has it been applied? So what cities have used this particular method and what were the results of that? These are all new experiments, so we actually don't have a lot of data to suggest how these play out over the long term. Our review shows that in some cases they do seem to be having an impact, but in other places they're not as effective as we would hope they would be. So, of course, this all comes back to context. These are applied in different ways and different places. They often depend on the level of enforcement that's done and the willingness across all the partners to good faith make real these benefits. So there isn't a silver bullet for solving green gentrification. We are still trying to understand why some neighborhoods are much more susceptible to this than others, and that is ongoing work that our team is engaged in. And there's a lot more to do to really think about how to transform the system. I think what the policy toolkit does is take existing interventions, not saying that they're easy, but they've been done before, and apply them to this really thorny problem, when I think everyone that we've talked to from the city side to the community side agrees that what we really need is transformational change in these systems. And the kind of interventions in our policy toolkit are not going to get us there. But it's a place to start for development projects like the one in Minneapolis that are unfolding right now that cannot wait for a different kind of economic system or a different version of justice that we do need. But right now, these are things that communities can pick up and advocate for. And yes, we have seen that toolkit play a role in those conversations.
Let's go back and talk a little bit more about the approach to the research through the CREATE initiative. There are a couple of points that you have made that strike me as important. One of them is the involvement and the partnership, if you will, with community-based organizations. Tell us how that works, number one, and number two, why that's so important.
So researchers, as I mentioned, do a terrible job of coming up with questions that are actually really relevant to communities. And too often, the questions are formed and then the communities are sort of expected to reorganize their priorities in service of those questions. So we had started, as I mentioned, thinking we were going to do work on water and equity. And as we started to engage with communities and the city and really understand what was taking place and the concerns that people had, those were all articulated. The water and equity questions were all articulated through housing. So all of a sudden, me as an environmental scientist and a water policy person find myself directing a project on housing, which I felt quite uncomfortable with originally. But one of the tenets of CREATE, and I credit my colleague Kate Derrickson for this philosophy, is this idea of just being willingness to be transformed by the work. And so for me, that's been a willingness to get out of my research comfort zone, to learn about things that I don't know a whole lot about, but to also embrace the fact that we do have expertise and resources to offer as university scientists, as researchers, that are beneficial to communities. And I've learned so much through engaging in this process that's changed the way that I think about issues. And now I really see the work I've done in CREATE is giving me this great competitive advantage in my own field of having actually seen issues that I didn't know a lot about now articulate with my own specialty in a way that's changed sort of the way that I think about problems and the way that I think about interactions and systems. So I am a big believer now in this idea of figuring out how to engage community members in research in a way that is both beneficial to the community members in that the university is producing work that's directly beneficial to them, and then also in the ways in which that helps researchers just become so much more aware of the nuances of their own work, the biases that we all bring to the issues that we have, and the blind spots that we have as researchers that community members can illuminate that we would never be able to pick up on. So those two things have been really important parts of the ethos of the CREATE initiative and ways that I think will have a lasting impact for the researchers that have been involved, as well as the students who have come through this program.
Mm-hmm. And sort of branching off of that, also the interdisciplinary approach that you have spoken of before. And I know that a lot of the researchers that were involved in the Summer Scholars Program are from all over the university, not just from the Humphrey School, not just environmentalists. What does that interdisciplinary approach bring to this project?
It's fun. I thought I of myself as an interdisciplinary researcher, and then I started working on CREATE, and it's like there's a whole nother version of interdisciplinarity. So for me, the biggest insight has been working with a bunch of historians, which I've never worked with before. And as someone who's trained in environmental science and in economics, I think we take as given those two disciplines in particular, think about the world as it is right now, and then project into the future what might happen under a bunch of different scenarios. So we're very future-oriented. I do a lot of modeling, and all that is what-if scenarios about what the future might be. And all of a sudden, I'm working on a project with a bunch of historians that are all engaged in analyzing the past, which is something I had completely dismissed as unimportant in my previous work. And I have am a huge convert now to the importance of history, which sounds obvious, but I learned from them how essential it is to understand how you got to where you are now and how communities ended up where they are now, to these really policy-relevant questions about where we go from here. And it's clear to me if you didn't understand how you ended up with an extremely segregated city like Minneapolis, that you might put in policies like, let's put all of the money into these low-income neighborhoods in terms of park investments, and not really understand how that would be perceived or why that could be problematic. But working with historians has really help to sort of bring to the fore the importance of context, historical context, as well as the enduring legacy of these really discriminatory policies, how we think about those as distant future, distant past, but how they are so present today. They are still playing out in the everyday lives of community members. And that's really important for us to understand. And so trying to bring that story to the fore in CREATE has been just as important as the policy tools that are more forward-looking.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are some of the limitations that you have found through the course of working on this project so far? What other changes do you think are needed to make this even more impactful work?
I think that we took advantage of a university program that allowed us a lot of flexibility that isn't available in most other funding models. So there are barriers in terms of how faculty get grants that make it really hard to work with community members, that makes it hard both to involve community members in the articulation of a research vision, because often when you write a proposal, you've sort of signed a contract about what it is that you're going to work on, and it's very hard to change that after the fact. I think it's what we have found that we are working with university to try and improve is it's very difficult to pay community members for the time that they put into projects, but that is also really essential. And that there are incentive barriers within the students that we encounter who have had really transformative experiences working with CREATE and their community partners that then go back to their disciplinary programs and find it really difficult to explain to their advisor or their committee why this work is relevant for their own discipline, right? And I'm very sensitive to that. I understand why that's challenging. So those have all been challenges. And I think they point to some of the structures within the academy that still pose barriers for interdisciplinary researchers and researchers who want to do work that's sensitive to community members. And then the big power imbalance that exists between universities and university researchers and the communities that CREATE is trying to be attentive to. I spent most of my career working in engaged scholarship, working outside of the university, but working with private sector companies, big NGOs, government agencies, and they are very well-resourced organizations. And it's still part of my research agenda to continue to work with those organizations, but it is also really important to figure out how we can level the playing field a little bit for communities who don't have access to a fancy consultant to produce a report with flashy figures, who are often up against organizations, developers that have those resources. So the university, to me, seems to play a really important role in providing resources, knowledge production, the capacity and expertise that can help those communities pursue the future that they are trying to achieve in a way that they're not often given those resources.
Dr. Bonnie Keeler, thank you so much for joining us for CBS.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from CBS, an initiative of the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. To learn more about this segment, please visit cbs.umn.edu.